From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. We're in the final weeks of this year's legislative session, and lawmakers are not going out quietly. They're debating changes to Georgia's abortion laws. Yesterday, people from both sides of the debate packed a committee hearing room at the Capitol. They made their voices heard on HB 481, known as the Heartbeat Bill. The bill already passed the House last week. Its sponsor is Republican Representative Ed Setzler of Acworth. He says he's aiming to prevent doctors from performing an abortion if a fetal heartbeat is detected.
The point of a heartbeat, you've got the threshold that throughout law we recognize is a legally and scientifically significant threshold.
GPB political reporter Stephen Fowler and lawmakers Capitol correspondent Donna Lowry have been following the bill. Thank you both for being here.
Good morning.
Sure.
Don, I'm starting with you. The basic premise of this bill is that doctors could no longer perform abortions once they detect a heartbeat, typically around 6 weeks into a pregnancy. Quickly, how does the proposal change current law?
Well, right now it's 20 weeks, but it would change it for certain things. The biggest is that we would count a fetus as basically a person. So parents could count the person on the taxes. They also would be able to... One of the things that was added is that a mother could actually get child support for that child.
For a fetus as early as 6 weeks.
So there's some interesting things with this that will make it the strictest law in the United States, and that's what the sponsors want. They want to be able to take this to the Supreme Court.
And there are some exceptions to this.
Absolutely. In the case of rape, in the case of incest, in the case of that the child is determined to be medically not viable, and if the physician decides for some reason that the pregnancy should not continue.
All right. And if a police report has to have been filed in the cases of rape or incest.
A police report has to be filed in those cases. And the tough part is who files a police report, especially in the cases of incest.
And rape, right. Well, Stephen, yesterday evening, a substitute bill was introduced in the Senate with some more bipartisan elements thrown in. What types of tweaks have been made to what Donna just described?
Well, yeah, that bipartisan measure that Donna mentioned was the child support element of it. That the logic is if we are counting the fetus, 6 weeks in a pregnancy, if we're counting that as a person, then there are some economic rights. And one of those that would be included would be that some medical and pregnancy-related expenses would have to be covered by the father, because the bill sponsor says that it takes two people to make a baby, so two people should be involved with the process. And some of the other tweaks that the Senate made was it took out this long preamble in the beginning that was kind of inflammatory to some people and included some typos referring to a medical journal that doesn't exist, different things like that. So this bill moves more towards maybe getting some Republicans on board with it and maybe getting some Democrats on board, although that's really not likely.
Yeah, so this was expected to be voted on yesterday, but the measure was in the Health and Human Services Committee in the House, now in the Senate Science and Technology Committee. Renee Unterman chairs that committee. It was pretty well publicized when she was removed as head of the Senate Health Committee. So for optics, did this have to end up in one of the few committees led by a woman, do you think? Or is it just because this is an issue Unterman has supported for years?
I think it did for optics. And also, Unterman has led this for years. Apparently, for 15 years, she has pushed legislation of this type. And so putting her front and center on this made sense. She has the background for it, all of that. But as you say, in terms of optics, you want to make sure you have a woman leading something as controversial as this. And the debate yesterday, the people who spoke at the hearing, very, very emotional on both sides.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. It was pretty dramatic, like as you reported last week in the House. There were protesters there who were dressed as if they were characters from The Handmaid's Tale, the Margaret Atwood book, and of course the series of women who were forced, basically, to just procreate. What was going on there?
Well, this was to make sure that people understood what was going on in Georgia. It certainly put the spotlight on Georgia in particular when it comes to this thing. But it also was to let people know that this was kind of pushed through very quickly, and it took a lot for the other side to really come to the Capitol and let people know what was going on. And I think what they needed were some strong a strong way to make that public.
Well, Stephen, what kind of response is expected once it goes from committee to vote on the Senate floor?
Well, you know, the Senate is going to have vigorous debate on this. The Senate is the body that usually has a little bit more time to discuss things because there are fewer senators, but they are very passionate about all of the bills they discuss. So expect several Democratic women senators, some new, some returning, to rail against this. And we've heard strong legal cases from some of the members who are lawyers saying this doesn't fit with the law, this doesn't, you know, align with what the Constitution says. But this would most likely go along party lines. Renee Unterman is one of two Republican women. So you would probably expect to see this go 35-21 along party lines. And then it would have to go back to the House, which had another, you know, when they voted on the first time, it was a very controversial and emotional and long debate. So what remains to be seen is if it does go back to the House, whether it's on a regular day of discussion or whether it gets put again at the end of the day on sine die, the last day, April 2nd.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the language is different now, so it has to go through the House again. And then, we, as we said last week, Governor Brian Kemp said, bring it on. Well, sign it. The Heartbeat Bill got a lot of national attention, thanks in part to a counterproposal from House Democrat Darshan Kendrick. She hasn't formally submitted it as legislation, certainly, but her plan is already getting a lot of attention. She wants a legal change that restricts aspects of men's reproductive health. What did we hear from her, Donna?
Well, it's certainly tongue-in-cheek, absolutely, on this, but something to think about. It might make it an aggravated assault for men to have sex without a condom, require men to obtain permission to get Viagra and other things for erectile dysfunction, require DNA testing at the sixth week of to determine pregnancies, to ban vasectomies, a 24-hour waiting period for men to buy porn or sex toys, certainly kind of putting it on the other side, mm-hmm. and saying, think about these things and think about men, think about it if we were to legislate things for you.
Right. Well, certainly got a lot of attention, but did it move the needle at all?
I don't know if it moved the needle, but it certainly did get attention. And like I said, a lot of this is to get attention nationwide.
That's Donna Lowry, GPB's Stephen Fowler, also with us. And Stephen, you know, actually, I can ask this of either of you. Women don't even know if they're pregnant at 6 weeks. Many of them, they might just assume they're late on their cycle. So the legal argument against this kind of legislation has been effective. It is effectively a ban on abortion. And we've seen a number of other states pass legislation like this. Courts strike them down each time. Are Georgia leaders really mounting this legislation as a test case to overturn Roe v. Wade?
Well, you know, on the campaign trail, Governor Brian Kemp said that he was going to pass the toughest abortion laws in the country. And what he had proposed actually was known as a trigger law, which would say if Roe versus Wade was overturned by the Supreme Court, then abortion would be banned in Georgia. Some people thought that was maybe a stricter, tougher stance on this. But because of this six-week time frame, many opponents say that this would effectively do the same thing. And because of that time frame, and as you mentioned, medical professionals say that 6 weeks in, maybe some women, most women don't know that they're pregnant. Mm. And so this in Georgia is being viewed as, you know, Governor Kemp following up on his promise, and more about abortion rights itself, less so than maybe looking towards the Supreme Court for this.
Mm-hmm. And you've been doing a lot of reporting on this, Stephen, looking at how other states are fighting, gearing up to fight this bill in abortion rights, let's say, in the courts. For your reporting, you spoke with Martin Cannon with the Thomas More Society. This is a conservative law firm that represents clients in favor of stricter abortion laws in states like Iowa. Martin Cannon, what did he tell you?
Well, so what he said is he's been working with Iowa, and Iowa had a heartbeat bill that was struck down by the state Supreme Court because the state Supreme Court said that a heartbeat bill goes against the state constitution, which allows for abortions and protections and things like that. And he told me that lawmakers in Iowa and in other states are simply trying to prepare for a post-Roe era. They're trying to get their state's affairs in order so that when another state challenges Roe v. Wade, and if it's overturned, that they're protected. I've seen reports from places like Idaho where lawmakers are filing these abortion bills and legislation that they're strictly trying to only change their state, and they're not trying to get things in front of a federal judge, in front of the Supreme Court. But you hear activist groups, Right to Life Alliances and other things like that, calling for this push to the Supreme Court. But lawmakers are doing something different, simply trying to get their ducks in a row. And on the other side, you see states like New York codifying Roe v. Wade in anticipation of that case. But if everyone's trying to avoid getting to the Supreme Court, nobody's going to get to the Supreme Court. So Roe would still stay the law of the land.
Well, okay, so we are out of time, but quickly, the voting machine bill that you've discussed so much is now on Governor Brian Kemp's desk, passed Senate Wednesday, House again on Thursday, published some documents from voting machine vendors that estimate how much they would charge Georgia to revamp its voting system. What'd you find?
Well, so some of the voting machine vendors had two-paragraph lines about it could cost this much or it could cost this much. Some of them had detailed pricing sheets for if you want to buy paper from us, it costs this much. But the leading vendor, ESNS, says that theirs would cost, one option would cost about $100 million, which is in line with $150 million in the budget. But what's also included in there is millions of dollars in annual licensing fees to license the software, the hardware, and the programs. In one case, I saw a ballot on-demand printer that would print things would cost about $4,900, but to license it would be $700 a year. So over the course of 10 years, Georgia could be paying more in fees than it would for the actual hardware.
So you all are going to be keeping a close eye on that. Let's see here. We've got Donna Lowry, GPB Lawmakers, Capitol Correspondent, and Stephen Fowler. You're going to be going back to the big dome.
Yes, there are not that many days left, so they've got a lot to do in a short period of time.
Okay. And we'll be there.
Well, yes. Thank you so much to both of you for being here today.
Thank you.
Now, we asked kids from across the state in Georgia who are gathering today for the Georgia Association of Educators State Spelling Bee. A few of the regional champions shared their spelling secrets with us, starting with Braden. Accompanying him, the theme from the Tony-winning musical, the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee.
My name is Braden Flournoy. I'm from Canton, Georgia. I'm in 8th grade at Freedom Middle School. My first spelling bee happened in 2nd grade, and it was pretty fun. And then ever since then, I've been taking it more seriously. I usually try to picture the word in my head as clearly as I can, and then I will write it out into the air and spell it as I write. Spelling, it's just fun in general, but I have to say that my favorite part is probably after a whole round when a bunch of people go out and your adrenaline starts pumping and you get more nervous and then they start getting to the harder rounds. My favorite word would probably be tchotchke. T-C-H-O-T-C-H-K-E. I would like to wish everyone at the competition good luck.
And good luck to Braden. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for comedian Dulce Sloan, her rise from Meadow Creek High in Gwinnett to The Daily Show with Trevor Noor. We're going to hear more about that when On Second Thought continues. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Georgia native Dulce Sloan is a comedian, actress, and correspondent on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. Sloan started her stage career at Meadow Creek High School in Gwinnett County, Georgia, and stumbled into Atlanta's stand-up circuit before her big break, late-night debut on Conan in 2016.
If it's not gay men grabbing my boobs, I got white women putting their hands in my afros. See a couple perpetrators in the room. Because they're not classy when they put their hand in your afro. They don't want to stay on the perimeter of the afro. She don't want to keep it Christian, no. She takes a whole hand, goes straight to the scalp, shake it back and forth, and then exits your afro with this jellyfish action. While she's looking at her friend going, Lauren, it's so soft.
Well, there she is on Late Night. This is Dulce Sloan joining me now from New York City this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm up kind of early on a Friday.
Yeah, I guess late nights are kind of the thing for you. You're often on stage at night, right?
Well, this is also like the first Friday I've been in town in like the past, I think, month and a half, just because a lot of times we only shoot the show Monday through Thursday. So on Friday, me and a lot of the other correspondents who are stand-up comedians are on the road doing comedy.
Yeah, and you'll be back here in Georgia soon doing the same, right?
Well, I was there Valentine's Day weekend. I was actually doing a guest spot on Trevor Noah's shows at the Fox. So I'm looking forward to coming back.
Well, we're looking forward to having you. And I want to talk a little bit about your roots, because I understand that you really wanted to be an actress first, not a comedian. When did that start?
I decided to become an actress when I was six.
So you were determined.
Oh, yes. I was very too much as a child. I used to pretend I could tap dance. It was a whole campaign I was on a regular basis. And then when we moved back to Miami, I took chorus and some acting in elementary school. And then I went to Lilburn Middle School in Gwinnett County. And that's when I started taking theater classes. And then I took it into high school. And then I went to Brunel University and got a theater degree. And I got out of school in 2005 and just started doing like plays and shows around town and whatever film work I could do.
So we said you stumbled into stand-up. Would it be a better way of putting it that stand-up kind of found you?
It did find me. So one of my sisters from school was working at a comedy club as she was working the door, so I could get in for free. And I would go up there, and just if I wasn't working on a show or doing anything, I would go up there and bother her. And I met just a couple of the comics just being up there and just talking to them in conversation. One of them by the name of Big Kenny Johnson, he was like, oh, you're a comic. And I was like, no, I'm not. He's like, no, you know how to tell a story. You know where a punchline is. I'm like, well, it's because, you know, I did acting, which is storytelling. So I know where a punchline is. I know where comedy is. But he was like, nope, you're a comic. Take my stand-up class. And I was like, absolutely not. And it took him 2 years to convince me and my mom to convince me to take the class. And then I finally took it and I graduated from the class in May of 2009. And I've been doing it ever since.
Wow. So what was that transition like, though? You know, being a great storyteller is one thing, knowing how to deliver a punchline. But there you have scripts, you have a playwright or a theater director's idea of a character. Now you're a comedian writing your own material. What was that like?
Well, that was the scariest part about doing stand-up. That's why I didn't want to do it. Because he would ask me, like, why won't you just hop on the open mic? Or I was like, one, you know, I'm classically trained, and so in singing and acting and moving. And for me, it was when you're on stage, you're not yourself and those aren't your words. When you're doing stand-up, it's all you and they're all your words. So I knew how to be on stage because I had done like oratorical contests and things of that nature. But I knew how to be on stage and be myself, but I didn't know how to write a joke or tell a joke or do any of that. So that was the biggest leap. And so Big Kenny taught me how to write a joke and to how to write a set list. So when I got out of the class, like most people go to open mics and they're just like, oh, it's just whatever I think might work. But when I started, I had a vetted 5 minutes from a seasoned comedian.
So, but since then, it's been a bit of a whirlwind. I mean, we last checked in with you on Second Thought right before you moved to LA from Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you moved on a Thursday and did Conan the following Monday. What was that like?
Well, yeah, because that's kind of how we set it up. What was interesting is that I didn't know I was going to be on Conan. It was a very interesting thing. The booker from Conan, he'd seen me at like a couple other festivals, and he invited me to do the Turner Christmas party in L.A. And so I come out, and he's like, hey, why don't you come by the show? And I was like, okay. And so I come by Conan, and I'm like, oh, this is neat. And it was like they were having a big Star Wars episode because I think one of the Star Wars movies was about to come out. And he's like, oh, we're going to get you a date. And I was like, what? And I went, that's great. And then I left and called my manager, and I was like, I'm going to be on Conan. And he's like, what did you think this was for? I was like, I don't know, because I never know what's happening. And so you could ask anybody, I never know what's going on. Because like when the booker called me, he's like, hey. And I was like, hello. Because I didn't recognize the man's voice. I only met him one other time. And so he says to me, we're going to get me a date in March. And then at the end of January, my manager calls me and he's like, hey, listen, you're going to be on Conan in 2 weeks. And I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, you're going to be on Conan in 2 weeks. Get your set ready. Yay! And so that's how we kind of planned it to where me moving to L.A. lined up with doing Conan.
Right on time. So after being on Conan, you got a lot of attention and within a year joined The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. So why did you even audition for that? What did you want to do there?
I auditioned because it was another opportunity. Comedy Central reached out to, you know, my team and was like my manager, my agents were like, oh, we really want her to audition for Daily Show. And I was like, oh, no. Because I was like, where do they film that show again? They're like, New York. And I was like, oh, no. Because I'd never.
So you just moved to L.A.
Because I just moved to L.A. because, like, I moved to, well, I went full time doing stand up in November of 2015. I moved to shout out to Gabby Gravilla over at Circle Supply. Because I used to work selling stucco until I quit my day job and started doing stand-up. And then February 2016, moved to L.A. And then July 2017, got Daily Show. And then September 2017, moved to New York. So it was all kind of like quick. But people were like, oh, this happened so fast. I'm like, no, I've been working towards this since I was a child. So this isn't that fast. But Comedy Central hit up my manager and my agent and were like, we wanted to audition. I was like, okay. I mean, I didn't think I was a very political comic. So I was like, oh, they just probably just want me to audition. I can do that. And I auditioned and, you know, I sent in one video. So I wrote my audition out because when you do an audition, it's your desk piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote my stuff, my lines and Trevor's lines, and then the one they gave me, recorded it and sent that. And I was like, ah, I don't have to worry about this. And then a couple of days later, like, you got a call back, you're going to New York. And I was like, oh, no. So I get the call back, and I go to New York, and I do the audition. And I'm like, eh, because, like, two other girls were there, and I saw one of my other friends. And I was like, ah, who knows who's going to get this? Not me. And I did my audition, and 2 hours later, they called me and said that I got it. I was like, oh, well. And everyone on the phone is so excited because, like, it's funny because, like, as a performer, when you don't get something, only your manager tells you.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do get something, there's 25 people on the phone. So, like, when I got the show, it was, like, my manager, all of my agents, agents' assistants, the lawyer. Like, there was, it was, a crowd of people was on the phone to tell me.
Well, let's listen to one of your Daily Show pieces. Trevor Noah asked you how you remember Martin Luther King Day on MLK Day, and you said you remember him as an anti-capitalist who considered white liberals more dangerous to social progress than the Klan. You also said this.
And even though he was a reverend and a man of God, he allegedly had a whole bunch of affairs.
Whoa, hold on. Even if that's true, I mean, that he had affairs, isn't it disrespectful to mention that on his birthday?
I don't think so. It's part of his legacy. A reminder that our heroes aren't perfect, they're people. And I'm not being disrespectful. Just the opposite. MLK was out there getting it. And probably still could. I mean, if he showed up on my Bumble, I'd take him to the mountaintop and the valley.
That's my guest, Dulce Sloan, on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. Daughter of Atlanta, you get some clapback for that, Dulce?
I did get a weird letter. It looked like a greeting card. And then someone was like, you'll never work in this town again. And I was like, I don't need your 1930s insult, lady. But, I mean, I thought it was an interesting perspective because it's kind of like JFK was treated like that for a long time where it was like, oh, we didn't know he was cheating on his wife all the time when it was happening. So, you know, we have this view of, because my issue has always been, like, when people take Martin Luther King, like, even racists will quote Martin Luther King and be like, well, you know, Martin Luther King wouldn't have done all this marching that you guys are doing, Black Lives Matter. Like, that's all he's known for is marching. What are you talking about? So people cherry pick, you know, his legacy and what he did. And I think sometimes it's okay to look at somebody as a whole person. And that was kind of the point of that piece. We were also very careful in how we presented the information because we didn't want to be disrespectful. Because as someone who's from Atlanta and who remembers every year on Martin Luther King Day, then playing the Little Boy King movie on, WSB, everybody remembers the Little Boy King movie. I grew up watching, in Atlanta. So I'm gonna make sure that I'm not disrespectful to the legacy of someone who made sure that I can use I can have the job that I have and do the things that I do. Why would we do that?
Well, you do pay close attention to politics, both in your work, your personal life. You tweeted and Instagrammed a lot about the Georgia governor's race between Brian Kemp and Stacey Abrams. And
that thing was wild.
Well, you live in New York, though. What keeps you so invested in your home state politics?
Because I'm still registered to vote in the state of Georgia.
You are? Did you absentee vote?
I did. And I was terrorizing folks about my absentee ballot. That's why I kept posting about it. Because, like, since I move around so much for work, it's, you know, I still have a home base in Georgia because my mama still lives there. Mm-hmm. So I was still very much invested in the election, and just to see everything that was going on, it was wild. Like, that woman who lived in the West End and they told her she wasn't on the register and she'd been voting from that same address in the West End since 1968. And it's like, well, we don't have any previous record of you voting. She's like, I've been voting since you've been before you were born. What are you talking about? So there's a lot of slick stuff going on. So that's why I made sure, because I saw so many things with people's absentee ballots where it's like you couldn't tell if it got counted or not, but it was supposed to say online that it was. So I kept posting stuff going, hey, I didn't get it counted. And then all of a sudden out of nowhere, it was all of a sudden counted. I'm like, this seems bogus. But.
Well, and this is something that a lot of people paid attention to. But in home state politics, you went to high school in Gwinnett County, going to vote on MARTA expansion on Monday. I bet you take the subway all the time. Any words of wisdom for Gwinnett residents who may finally have to confront the option of taking the train?
I don't take the subway all the time.
You don't?
I got a good job. You saw me on TV. Yeah. No, I don't take.
All right, you have
thing,
the Lincoln
the
Town
whole thing
car.
Stinks. No, I got an Uber or a Lyft. Like, I was on the way here. My train was delayed because someone got sick on the train. Like, so all of us are just, like, stepping over someone getting sick, because I'll keep it classy when I say it. But I'm just like, oh, I have to sit across from the, you, let me get a car. And girl, it's just so cold here that, like, walking to the train in 7-degree weather, I mean, I don't pray every morning to do that. So it's just a lot, but I think it would be very interesting because I remember Gwinnett County has been fighting MARTA for years. Mm-hmm. I remember the federal government made them get buses. It'll be interesting because they're going to be extending, what, the Doraville station?
Yeah, exactly. But you know what? I've got 20 seconds left with you, and I want to ask you, you shouted out to Waffle House in an Instagram post. This was after your set at the Fox you mentioned. What's your order at Waffle House?
I get a Texas bacon cheesesteak melt. And again, my hash browns scattered, smothered, covered, and peppered.
All right. I don't think anyone could argue with that. And we might catch you at Waffle House if you're back in town. Thank you so much for joining us, Dulce.
Thank you for having me.
I should say Dulce Sloan. She's Georgia native and Daily Show correspondent Dulce Sloan. And now we know her order at the Waffle House.
Mm-hmm.
So champion spellers from around the state are in Atlanta today. We mentioned for the Georgia Association of Educators State Spelling Bee. A few of them took a moment to share their secrets to their success. Here's Anania from Stockbridge, along with my favorite moment of the bee from the Tony-winning musical, the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee.
So my name is Ananya Augustine, and I'm in the 5th grade, and I'm from Stockbridge, Georgia. My mom introduced me to the art of spelling when I was, like, very little. I don't, like, remember when, but it, like, just sparked an interest into me. I love learning new words. It just adds to my vocabulary, which would, like, help me in my later life, and, like, it just gives me a sense of accomplishment and it makes me feel good. I just try to imagine the word, like, have a picture of it in my head, and then, like, I'll just spell it out. Like, in Merriam-Webster, when you type in a word, I'll just, like, type it in my head. That's what I do. A-E-S-T-H-E-T-I-C. Aesthetic. It's, like, a no-brainer for me. I just like how it's a definition and, like, it's a word structure. How aesthetic means, like, the beauty of things. Like, it can be used to describe almost anything.
And stay with us for a seat at the table. Co-host Deneen Milner putting a fresh spin on The Fresh Prince. We're going to talk about the book series she's developing with Will Smith. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for more of On Second Thought after a break. Relaxing all cool and all shooting some b-ball outside of the school when a couple of guys who were up to no good started making trouble in my neighborhood. I got in one little fight and my mom got scared and said, you're moving with your auntie and uncle in Bel Air. I begged and pleaded with her day after day, but she packed my suitcase and sent me on my way. She gave me a kiss and then she gave me my ticket. I put my Walkman on and said, I might as well kick it. First class, yo, this is bad. Drinking orange juice out of a champagne glass. Is this what the people of Bel Air live in? From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Now this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down, and I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I became the prince of a town called Bel-Air. Okay, if we didn't get enough of it before the break, we got it there. Of course, actor and musician Will Smith performing the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air theme song. That show ran for 6 seasons in the 90s. Its main character, also named Will Smith, moved from Philadelphia to live with his uncle and aunt in the wealthy L.A. suburb of Bel-Air. In the upcoming book series, revives the plot with a new character, Destiny. She's a fresh princess. And Deneen Milner is writing the books. She of the New York Times best-selling author and GPB Seat at the Table fame. Deneen, welcome.
Hello. Good morning.
Yeah, it's so nice to have you with us. So did you grow up watching The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air?
I sure did. But you know what? Will and I are around the same age. I think I may have a year on him. And so, no. We're both the same age. We turned 50 at the same time. And I grew up on his music, right? So I was listening to him when he was with DJ Jazzy Jeff, whom I still listen to, who still makes great music as a DJ out of Philly. And so I was more familiar with his music. And when he showed up on television, it was like, we thought that he was adorable to begin with. And now we get to see him right in our living rooms every week.
And that was a super influential show. I mean, not just because, like, fashion-wise, I mean, it was the first time a lot of people had seen anything like a rapper on television.
Absolutely. But, you know, like, what I remember being sort of glomming into with that show was the family, the mother and the father, and the relationship between the cousins and certainly the siblings, and sort of the everyday experiences that they completely, you know, like, put into our living rooms every week. Mm-hmm. I identified with it not just because of the music and the celebrity of Will Smith as a rapper, but because what they were talking about and what they were dealing with were things that we were dealing with as kids, teenagers at the time.
Yeah, it just felt real.
Yeah.
Well, now you're collaborating with Will Smith on this 3-book series. I'm sure quite a few people would just love to even meet him, never mind work with him. How did this all come together?
So, you know, I write books for a living, and I also...
A lot of books.
A lot of books for a living, and I write children's books. And I wrote a piece in the New York Times about the proliferation of Black children's books, or books featuring Black children's characters, and how they always seem to be focused on civil rights figures, or they're focused on, Black firsts, or they're talking about slavery. And I wrote a piece that said something to the effect of Black children don't want to read about Harriet Tubman all the time. And his people saw that piece. I wrote it because I had just started my own children's book imprint and made a point of saying that I would never do those books on my imprint because there were everyday experiences that Black children had the right to see themselves in these books, and see them portrayed in a way that they just aren't, they don't tend to be in Black children's books. And so his people saw that piece, and apparently they were looking for a writer for the series right when they saw that piece. So it was kind of serendipitous. And I did an interview with them, and here we are.
So I just want to pull a quote from that piece because, you know, you write that it doesn't have to be about the struggle all the time. In fact, real diversity would celebrate the mundane.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what does that mean to you?
That means that Black children lose their first tooth and have to put it under their pillow and wait for the tooth fairy just like everybody else. That means Black children get on the bus every day and, you know, go to school and have different kinds of experiences on the bus. that deserve to be talked about. Black children go to kindergarten for the first time and they're scared and they're trying to figure out how to make friends and how to get the teacher to like them and how to learn and grow. And that deserves to be celebrated. And it happens. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen in Black children's books, but you are more than likely to go into a bookstore right now and find way more books about slavery, the civil rights movement, or someone who bounced a basketball for the first time or hit a baseball for the first time or was a jazz musician than you are sort of the everyday experience of all children, including Black children.
And you spend a lot of time thinking about children as a mother yourself, but you also work for parenting.
Yes.
And you have the website My Brown Baby, which a lot of people follow. But I'm thinking about, you know, in Fresh Prince, Will Smith's character, great, charismatic, fun. He wore checkered pants.
lots of colors.
Now in real life, he's a dad.
Right.
And he says his own kids would have loved Fresh Princess growing up. So what is this character like? What is this main character? Her name is Destiny.
Oh, goodness. Destiny is just juicy and full of goodness. And she is, you know, she marches to her own beat. She is honest and forthright and funny. And she goes through experiences that are kind of haphazard. And then she kind of has to figure out how to make it right. And she figures that out with integrity, you know, for a kid who is smart and being raised by two parents who are thoughtful and loving, being the little sister of a big sister who kind of guides the way for her and sort of encourages her to fix her problems with integrity, but to, you know, like have fun doing it. So she is kind of a spin on the Fresh Prince, you know, just kind of getting into sort of situation. She has her crew that she gets introduced to on the block. The first book focuses on her family moving to West Philadelphia. So she's not moving to Bel Air. She's moving from a town that we do not say what it is, and she's moving back to West Philadelphia, which is, of course, where the Fresh Prince moved from to go to Bel Air, and also where Will Smith is from. And so it's a love letter to West Philadelphia. So if you're from West Philly, you'll see all different kinds of homages to the neighborhood and the growth and the art and the culture. And Fresh Princess is sitting right in the middle of that.
Mm-hmm. So you have not only written books, children's books, and you've started, as you said, your own imprint. So in publishing language, this is kind of a distinct category of books under the umbrella of a publisher. Yours, Deneen Milner Books. So what are some of the challenges or questions that you face when deciding to start your own imprint? This is a big job, right?
Yeah, it is, but it's a fun job. It's I get to go and work with writers who love the written word and babies and illustrators who love bringing those stories to life. And, you know, the beauty of the imprint is that I get to do what I want to and to find people who are willing to tell the stories that I want to bring to life. And so, in the first year, Deneen Milner Books published four books, and one of them, The Crown and Ode to the Fresh Cut by Derek Barnes and illustrated by Gordon C. James, won 8 prestigious awards.
The Newbery Honor.
Right.
Caldecott. I mean, these are huge awards.
Absolutely. And, you know, and the Kirkus Prize and, you know, and Society of Illustrators Awards. I think that the reason why it resonates so beautifully with readers, with kids, with teachers, librarians, moms, dads, is because it talks about the everyday experience of a little Black boy going to get his hair cut and how he feels when he's sitting in the chair and puts on his princely robes and gets that horsetail, you know, swipe down the neck and to get the hair off the back of his neck. And he's seeing, you know, like an uncle to his left and, you know, like a really important guy to his right. And they're all just, you know, everyday people. And that's the celebration there. And that's what really resonates. I go and I read that book. I read that book to 17-year-old and 16-year-old Black boys at Grady High School, and they giggled like 5-year-olds. They just love that book. And so those are the kinds of books that I adore, that I want to read to my kids when they go to sleep at night, that, you know, serve as the great saying is you want children's books to serve as a window and a mirror. Mm-hmm. So it's a mirror for Black children to be able to see themselves, but it's also a window for everyone else to be able to see how we truly live and how we truly love and what's important to Black children, and that's to be treated like humans.
Yeah. Well, something that doesn't happen every day is finding a dragon. And
right? Oh, yes.
One of the first books you purchased was "There's a Dragon in My Closet." There's a young African American boy. So
yes.
Why that? What stood out to you about that?
Well, what stood out to me about that is I went and talked to Charlie Palmer, who is a local. He's based here in Atlanta. He's a fine artist, but does these the most magnificent art. It's just gorgeous. And I'm a huge art lover.
I got to say, Crown is a beautiful book.
And Gordon C. James was the first, that was his first book that he ever illustrated. And he was a fine artist out of North Carolina. And of course he can do illustrations for children's books. He's an artist, right? So I went to Charlie's office or his studio to see if he would be willing to illustrate another book that I had in mind. And he says, you know, like in one of these boxes over here, I have a book that I wrote years ago with my ex-wife, and it's about a little boy who thinks there's a dragon in his closet, and you know, like you can't tell if he's using his imagination to, you know, excuse all of the shenanigans that he gets to in around his house, and he blames it on this dragon, or if this dragon is real. And he's like, you know, let me go over here and look in this box. And he goes into the corner and he rumbles through this box and he comes out with "There's a Dragon in My Closet." It's already illustrated, written, everything. And I'm like,
I just
I'll
happened
take
to
that. Thanks. And it is absolutely beautiful. And you know what resonated with me with that book was my stepson Mozzie. When he was little, he had an imaginary friend called Mozzie Boo. And whenever cookies came up missing, or you know somebody drank the cat's milk, or you know there was a crayon Picasso on the wall, Mozzie Boo did it. Uh-huh. And so I'm like, oh, this is perfect. Like this is what little Black boys do. Like this is what little boys do. Mm-hmm. But little Black boys do this too. And so absolutely, this makes all the sense in the world. Let's do it.
You started with a smaller publishing house called Agate. Then Simon & Schuster Books for Young Readers acquired this imprint. So what does having big name muscle like that mean for what you want to do for the books you want to publish?
Oh, goodness. So, you know, my experience with Agate, I'm forever grateful to them because Doug Seibel, the publisher at Agate, we came to the table with the same idea that we wanted to produce these specific kind of books. And then Simon & Schuster came along and kind of opened wide the possibilities. You know, we were dealing with small budgets at Agate. Simon & Schuster has infinite resources. They have a marketing, an entire marketing team, an entire advertising team, a sales team that's been in the business for forever. They understand the market. They understand how to sell children's books and books that I couldn't acquire at Agate because I didn't have the budget for it. I can now purchase them at Simon & Schuster. And mm-hmm. So it just sort of elevates my ability to do my job.
Well, and I guess the job's getting bigger. But this is something, I mean, you're an author who's written a number of successful books for adult readers as well, collaborated with people like Steve Harvey, Taraji Henson. I think you worked with Jesse Norman, Magic Johnson. I mean, this is so. What is that process like of working on a book with somebody else, not necessarily a writer, mm-hmm. but have a great story to tell? Mm-hmm. How does that? What's the difference between that kind of collaboration sure. and ghostwriting, let's say?
Well, you know, my background is as a journalist.
Yeah.
I started out as a political reporter and then got tired of seeing that sausage being made and became an entertainment journalist and then an editor. And so I bring that to the table. To me, it's just sort of a really super long profile, an entertainment profile. It's me sitting and talking to them, figuring out what it is that they want to say to their audience, and then devising an outline that's pretty rudimentary. It can be as simple as me writing some notes on the back of an envelope. Mm-hmm. Like, really, that's how it goes down.
But these are people who are really conscious of the brand, who they are,
absolutely.
What they're selling. I mean, how do you manage that?
We sit and we just talk. You know, I don't want to say that I become friends with them because that's not my job. It's not my job to be their friend. but we do sit and we just have conversations. I don't look at it as we're going to sit down, I'm going to ask you a bunch of really hard questions, and I'm going to put you on the hot seat. That's not what the point is. The point is for us to have conversations and to have them tell me about their lives. And then we sit down, I sit down, and I translate what we've talked about into a narrative that makes sense for their brand, that makes sense for their journey, that makes sense for who they are as human beings. It's easy because it's just a translation of a really good conversation.
Mm-hmm. Conversation is what you do, partially, in books, and also you're a co-host of GPB's A Seat at the Table. So I'm just wondering, with all these things you've got, blogging, writing, the imprint, television, where does that energy come from?
I don't know. I came in here like, ooh, Lordy, I'm tired. I just turned 50 in October.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And it is an awesome, awesome decade. I just feel like I'm living life and I'm doing what I'm passionate about. And, you know, everything that I do is focused on the African-American experience. I grew up in this industry as a journalist, as a writer, being told that what I was doing was pigeonholing myself by just talking about Black folks. And I never looked at it that way. I always looked at covering African-Americans as like a beat, no different from being a correspondent in China, or no different from covering tech, or no different from covering politics. It's just fun to me to be able to shine a light and explore all of these different genres, or to explore the African-American experience through all these different genres. And so long as, you know, the opportunity is presented to me, I'm going to take it.
Deneen Milner, what a pleasure speaking with you.
It was great talking to you, too. Thank you for having me.
The first book in the Fresh Princess series comes out on April 2nd. Now, throughout the show today, we've been hearing from some kids who really are good at spelling. They're in Atlanta today for the state spelling bee, and the winner could advance to the Scripps National Spelling Bee in May. Here's Abby from Suwanee, set to the tune of Pandemonium from the Tony-winning musical, the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee.
My name is Abiram Kapaganti. I'm in 7th grade and I'm from Suwanee. I kind of got interested in 3rd grade and my parents told me there was a national spelling bee, so I was interested, and ever since 4th grade started, I've been preparing and going further and further each year. I study about 1 to 2 hours on weekdays and 2 to 3 hours over weekends. There's a lot of ways words can be spelled because sometimes they aren't spelled how they sound. There are many words for one definition. Chastushka, C-H-A-S-T-U-S-H-K-A. Yeah, it's a type of poem. Good luck to all the other competitors.
Hyacinth. I still remember losing on Hyacinth. Virginia Prescott, thanking you for listening with us today. We'll be back on Monday with more of On Second Thought.